at least 15 Israeli troops were killed or injured in the village of Odessa in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah also said fired artillery shells at Israeli troops were trying to penetrate into the southern village of Blida, forcing them to retreat. The resistance movement also targeted the gatherings of Israeli forces in the settlement of Manara and its vicinity by missiles. Israel launched a ground invasion of Lebanon earlier this month, following days of deadly bombardment of the country. Let's bring in first our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, from Beirut, to get an idea about what has happened there in Beirut. Well, tell us what you have for us, Mariam, and also if you can add to that the number of Israeli regime forces that have been taken out by the Hezbollah fighters, if you have, concrete numbers on that for us.
Well, Kavi, as you know, of course, the Israeli shelling on the southern suburbs of Beirut continues. And we've seen that today, for the first time, they targeted the residential area in the southern suburbs in a time which was in the morning. Usually that time is used by people to maybe go check and bring things from their houses. So we probably had movement of civilians. And it's very difficult perhaps to see, but you can probably see some of the smoke behind me that are still coming out from the areas that were shelled by the Israelis, in addition to the fires that we saw on the airport road, the old airport road yesterday, as a result of the targeting of an area that is adjacent to a gas station. Of course, in addition to the fact that the types of bombs that are being used have caused massive destruction and fires, and even very, very pungent odors that it almost capable for people to get close. A lot of people have also experienced trouble breathing. They were taken to hospital just because they got closer to one of those areas where there was that shelling. In addition to the southern suburbs, of course, the Israelis continued their attacks all across South Lebanon, especially the area of Dabin. Now, perhaps we need to explain it to the viewers that, for example, the town of Dabin lies in the heart of the district of Marj Ayun, and that was an area that was still considered safe. But, however, we see that the Israelis are striking that town in the middle of the Marj Ayun district, and they're not even allowing the rescue teams to come anywhere near that site. We also had yesterday another attack in one of the areas, which is in the Shuf district as well, another district that has been targeted at least two times now, and that was a district that was considered one of the safe areas. And we know that a woman and her three daughters were killed in that attack. We also know that we're at least 18 people when it were injured in that strike alone. We also know that the Islamic Health Association has declared that at least three of its paramedics and members of its rescue teams were killed in the attacks that targeted the town of Jouya and Majd al-Zuwan. These are not border towns. These are towns that are further off, so there might be even some maybe presence of civilians, and they were not allowed to get close. Once they got close to areas which were shelled, they were struck by the Israeli drones, I believe, in this one, and also in Ainata as well. They were not allowed to come close, and this is why they lost these paramedics and these members of the rescue teams in those areas specifically. We also know that fires have been erupted in various areas, and the issue is that also the Israelis are not allowing even the firefighters to get near those sites to take out the fires so that they do not spread out towards the green spaces as well as the neighborhoods that are surrounding that area. Now, we know that the Ministry of Health has declared that at least 23 people were martyred in the last 24 hours alone. And, of course, we are expecting the number to rise once we do have any information about more martyrs. We also know that in the Bekaa area, we have the area of Duras and Ali al-Nahri, were also subject to strikes, in addition to Rubat Latin, which is in South Lebanon, that was also subject to strikes. Now, we have another issue which is expected to be another humanitarian crisis, the issue of education. We heard today the Lebanese Minister of Health talking about the fact that we have over at least 20,000 children that are in the age of school that were forced to leave, and the fact that you have many of the schools, the educational institutions, unable to begin the scholastic year. And it was planned to begin early this month. However, now he has postponed it until the 4th of November in hopes that perhaps by then there could be some sort of an end to this crisis to allow the displaced to be able to get an education somewhere, and those in safe areas. Now, he also said that there are certain safe areas where the schools have decided to open, but even those areas are still studying the situation very closely because of the security crisis in general. And so there might be now online learning just until things, of course, are even more evident of what's happened. So this is another crisis. Many kids will not be starting their school year in Lebanon this year, which is, of course, something that is of a great concern for Lebanon and even supposedly the international community because of the right of children for education. You also have another attack on the area of Marjayoun once again. So even the area of Dabin, which was targeted earlier, is again being targeted right now. And this is, of course, continuous in various areas, not only in the area of Dabin. Now, concerning the operations of Hezbollah, I think you mentioned some of them. Of course, the confrontations there continue, in addition to the fact that the evacuation efforts have been extremely difficult from various areas, especially in South Lebanon, with the fact that it's very difficult to get close to the sites which have been targeted.
It is day 366 of the genocide in Gaza. The Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with more air and artillery strikes. In yet another massacre, the regime's military bombed a mosque housing displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza, leaving at least 24 killed. Nearly 100 others were injured in the attack. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas strongly condemned the attack, saying the massacre amounts to war crimes with American cover. Israeli warplanes also targeted areas in the Jabalia refugee camp, as well as Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, leaving several Palestinians dead and injured. The regime's artillery is also shelling areas in Gaza indiscriminately. The Israeli aggression on Gaza began in October of last year. Since then, more than 41,800 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 97,000 others injured. Moving on, the Israeli regime has destroyed 79% of mosques in the Gaza Strip since the start of its genocidal war. That's according to a report by the Palestinian Ministry of Endowment and Religious Affairs. It said that the Israeli occupation forces have caused complete destruction to 814 out of over 1,200 mosques and to three churches. Also, 19 out of a total of 60 cemeteries have been targeted by the regime's airstrikes, leading to the complete destruction of eight. The ministry monitored other crimes also, including exhuming graves, stealing thousands of dead bodies and martyrs, and even mutilating them. These statistics, however, are incomplete due to the ongoing genocidal war. The ministry also reported that its headquarters and vehicles have been destroyed, and among its employees, preachers, and imams, over 200 have been martyred. It called on all countries and international organizations to condemn these crimes against humanity and places of worship, and to intervene to bring an end to the genocide. The commander of the IRGC's naval force says that Iran will stand up firmly against anyone who would play with fire in the region. Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsidi said in an interview with Al Alam News Network that the Iranian armed forces have been preparing to counter all threats for years. He said the armed forces have plans in place for different scenarios of fighting against the enemies. He said one such scenario is vigilance against any attempt by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to set off a conflict. The admiral also talked about the IRGC naval force's recent military drills in the southern Iranian waters. He said that they display portions of the capability of the force, which he said includes artificial intelligence-assisted missiles and drones. Iran's parliament speaker says the enemies of the country cannot harm its independence and national pride with any temporary adventurism based on miscalculation. Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf pointed to the remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, about the enemy's policy to sow discord. He called for unity, describing as a deadly poison any division among the people, the nation, and the government, as well as various Islamic countries. Ghalibaf said the same criminal Israeli regime which assassinated Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran also killed Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. He said this shows the Israeli regime's enmity, not only towards Sunnis and Shias, but in general towards humanity and peace. Iran has strongly condemned the U.S. and the U.K. for the recent airstrikes on several Yemeni cities. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said the repeated strikes are a clear violation of the United Nations Charter and the principles of international law. The spokesman said that Yemen's military operations are a natural response to the Israeli crimes in Gaza, Lebanon, and in Syria. He also named the continuation of Israeli occupation, warmongering, and expansionism as the main factors for insecurity and instability in the region. Baghaei stressed that these crimes must end in Gaza and in Lebanon so that peace could return to the region. In a highly sensitive visit, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi visited Damascus on Saturday after his short trip or stop in Beirut. His visit comes at a time of heightened regional tensions with escalating Israeli aggression on both Lebanon and Gaza. The discussions focused on Iran's steadfast support for the resistance and the coordination of efforts to face Israeli aggression.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi paid an official visit to Damascus on Saturday and met with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian leader praised Tehran's strong response to Israel's repeated violations and aggressions against Iran. Assad stressed that this response told the Zionist entity that the excess of resistance is capable of deterring the enemy and thwarting its vicious plans.
There are two urgent matters on our agenda. First, addressing the issues of Lebanese refugees, and second, establishing a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon. My visit carries a central message. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always stood by the resistance under any circumstances and will always do so in the future.
Araghchi met with Syrian Foreign Minister Bassam Sabbagh, and they agreed to enhance political cooperation between the two countries and exert all diplomatic efforts to confront Israeli extremism and to push a ceasefire in both Lebanon and Gaza.
It is clear that the Iranians have taken the initiative after several blows to the axis of resistance, the hardest of which was the martyrdom of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah. This was evident through the True Promise 2 operation and the diplomatic efforts for a ceasefire. Iran is taking the lead.
Syrian Prime Minister Mohammed al-Jalali discussed with the Iranian Foreign Minister the ways to provide relief aid and meet the needs of the incoming Lebanese refugees to Syria. They also negotiated economic ties between the two nations as well as the mechanisms to enhance them. In addition to following up on joint work programs, implementing signed agreements and memorandums of understanding.
In this challenging phase for the Arab and Islamic nations, the diplomatic actions of the Islamic Republic of Iran meet the revolutionary visions of the region and the world. The message is clear. Resistance in Palestine and Lebanon must not be abandoned, and victory is the foundation of Iran's diplomatic efforts.
During his visit, Araghchi also met with Palestinian resistance factions in Damascus. He reaffirmed Iran's support for the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine in standing against the Israeli machine of destruction and killing, stressing the importance of coordination with all nations to support an end to this aggression.
Araghchi's visit comes amid extreme tension in the region, which requires extensive efforts and high coordination between the two allies to face the challenges. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Israel's prime minister has confessed to the enormity of the retaliatory attacks that Iran has carried out against the occupying regime, despite its earlier efforts to downplay them. Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking in a video message that was released on Saturday. He said that Iran has already twice launched hundreds of missiles into the occupied territories, describing them as, quote, the largest ballistic missile attacks in history. His remarks came after Tuesday, Iran launched nearly 200 missiles towards Israeli military and intelligence bases as part of Operation True Promise II. Back in April, Iran launched Operation True Promise the first by firing more than 300 missiles and drones at the occupied territories. Netanyahu also claimed that Iran was behind all the attacks that have been carried out against the regime from elsewhere in the region. However, Iran has repeatedly asserted that it has no proxy groups in the region. Tehran says regional resistance groups that target the regime in response to its violations act on their own initiative and with their own resources. Thousands join anti-Israeli rallies around the globe ahead of the first anniversary of the Israeli genocide in Gaza on October the 7th. Demonstrators in Berlin, Germany, rallied to slam the country's continued support for Israel through arms sales. They condemned Israel's war crimes and called for international action to stop the regime. In Australia, hundreds marched through the streets of Sydney, chanting "Free, Free Palestine." In the Japanese capital, Tokyo, people came together to condemn Israeli atrocities in the besieged territory. while holding up Palestinian flags. Over in Indonesia, thousands converged in front of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The genocidal war in Gaza has triggered global rallies across the world. Demonstrators hit the streets to condemn the Israeli carnage. They also criticize international bodies for failing to stop the genocide in Gaza. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrendered. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree. And resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero.
Gaza, October 7th. The sun is coming up. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. The law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening.
Get them out of there!
In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installations and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as an unprovoked attack, blaming Hamas for disturbing the peace in the region. In the United States, politicians echo the same narrative. Former U.S. President George W. Bush calls Hamas cold-blooded killers.
This is an unprovoked attack by terrorist people willing to kill innocent people to achieve an objective. And don't be surprised if Israel takes whatever action is necessary to defend herself. And it's going to be ugly for a while. You're dealing with cold-blooded killers.
But is the Palestinian group's operation really an unprovoked attack? And isn't there anything surprising about it?
Show you a map of the Middle East.
Just a couple of weeks before Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unveiled his future map of the region at the United Nations General Assembly. The map had no place for Palestinians, and Israel still included the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the occupied and illegally annexed Golan Heights of Syria. The little map was in fact the blueprint for the complete elimination of Palestine from the region for the sake of the so-called Greater Israel. Israel's prolonged policy of ignoring Palestinians' rights as a nation is clearly reflected in its illegal settlement projects. Built on usurped territories, these settlements and their cancerous expansion have dashed Palestinians' hopes for establishing their own state and ending their lingering limbo as a nation under occupation. In recent years, the Israeli regime has put settlement expansion at the top of its priorities. In one of the recent cases, Netanyahu passed a controversial resolution in June 2023 and gave a carte blanche to his cabinet to construct more settlements in the occupied West Bank. One month later, the head of the Regional Council for West Bank Settlements, Yossi Dagan, submitted a proposal to Netanyahu to increase the number of Jewish settlers in the northern West Bank from 170,000 to 1 million by 2050. There are already over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in 176 settlements and 186 so-called outposts in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. All of these settlements and outposts, the settlers who live in them, are illegal under international law. Since occupying the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has unilaterally declared tens of thousands of hectares of a so-called state land for Israeli settlements. Mushrooming across Palestine, these illegal settlements have made life excruciatingly difficult for Palestinian communities, aggravating their already dire situation. In addition to depriving the families of a home, which is the main asset and source of mental, physical, and economic security, the settlement building and its concomitant evictions of Palestinians frequently result in the loss of livelihoods and expansion of poverty. These settlements always come with the uprooting of Palestinian trees, destruction of their cultivated land, and discriminatory management of water resources in favor of the settlers. To make life even more difficult, restrictions have been imposed on Palestinian movement and access to resources. The Israeli regime has set up checkpoints, barriers, and separation walls that drastically limit the freedom of movement for Palestinians. This has had a profound impact on their daily lives. It affects movement within parts of the occupied Palestinian territories between the West Bank and Gaza, as well as between occupied Palestinian territories and the rest of the world. Since 2007, Gaza has been subjected to a crippling blockade, which has caused immense suffering and a humanitarian crisis. The food supply is also limited by the siege. From 2007 to 2010, Israeli authorities kept a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional needs to narrowly avoid malnutrition while restricting access to food for the people in Gaza. Today, according to the World Food Program, a significant portion of the population is food insecure. In 2022, 1.84 million people across Palestine, one-third of the population, did not have enough food to eat. Among these people, 1.1 million were considered severely food insecure, 90% of whom lived in Gaza. The Strip also suffers from an energy crisis. The Israeli ban on the entry of fuel into Gaza means that electricity production is severely limited. In 2023, before the Hamas-Israel escalation, Gaza had only 13 hours of electricity a day. The blockade has also taken a toll on the Strip's medical facilities. Hospitals lack basic supplies, equipment, and infrastructure, and are unable to handle severe cases or provide proper care for the chronically ill. With nearly half of the population out of job, the Gaza Strip has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. Data also indicate that more than 80% of the Gazans live in poverty. The blockade has turned the territory into an open-air prison where the residents have no place to go, no job to do, and no hope to cling to. Oh. According to the UNRWA report published in August 2023, for at least the last decade and a half, the socioeconomic situation in Gaza has been in steady decline. Israel's inhumane behavior usually takes even a harsher form. The regime's military operations in Gaza have led to high civilian casualties and widespread infrastructure damage. The destruction of homes, schools, and hospitals has left countless Palestinians dead, displaced, or in desperate need of assistance. Just within the period of a few weeks since October 7th, over 10,000 Palestinians have lost their lives, including over 4,100 children. In fact, in every action the Israeli regime takes, there is one recurring feature: lack of respect for Palestinian lives. From 2008 till September 2023, 6,407 Palestinians were recorded to have been killed by the Israeli regime, more than half through missile attacks. Targeting Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza on October 17th, that killed more than 500 Palestinians, was the very epitome of the regime's brutality. At the same time, Tel Aviv is also accused of using white phosphorus in its military onslaught on Gaza. The banned substance puts civilians at risk of serious and long-term injuries. As a weapon, white phosphorus has a significant incendiary effect that can severely burn people and set structures, fields, and other civilian objects in the vicinity on fire. Israel's use of the deadly chemical violates international norms. Prior to October 7th, there were about 5,200 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, kept under dangerous prison conditions. Of this number, nearly 2,000 were condemned to life sentences on trumped-up charges. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to torture, starvation, and thirst, while being prevented from accessing their medicine. Israel is using different legal pretexts to withhold the detainees from different areas. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip who were arrested inside Israel are being held under the Unlawful Combatants Law, which allows authorities to detain Palestinians indefinitely without effective judicial review. The law defines an unlawful combatant as a person who has participated either directly or indirectly in hostile acts against Israel, or is a member of a force perpetrating hostile acts against Israel. On October 13th, Israel amended the law to make it easier to arrest Palestinians on mere suspicion. The unlawful combatant law is the equivalent of the so-called administrative detention in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, which allows Israel to hold Palestinians from those areas indefinitely under secret evidence, practically meaning under no evidence. The number of prisoners has now risen to more than 10,000 people. Since October 7th, Israel has arrested some 4,000 laborers from Gaza and more than 1,000 people in the occupied West Bank. Just a few days before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, thousands of settlers carried out provocative tours of the mosque complex, following calls by extremist Jewish groups. Since the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, Tel Aviv has allowed Israeli extremists to intimidate and violate the sanctity of the mosque. Under the so-called status quo agreement, only Muslims are allowed to pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. entering the mosque with boots on, beating worshippers, firing bullets and grenades, as well as vandalizing the site, become common scenes in Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place for Muslims. In just 1 year, between September 2021 and September 2022, nearly 50,000 right-wing Jews raided Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's only part of the systematic Israeli campaign to Judaize Al-Quds. Against such a backdrop, the betrayal of the Palestinian cause by some Arab states in the form of the so-called Abraham Accords in 2022 and rumors that Saudi Arabia was just following suit could be regarded as the last straw. The normalization of ties between major Arab states and the Israeli regime sends shockwaves through the occupied territories. Forgotten by the international community, betrayed by Arab brothers and oppressed by the brutal regime of Israel. Palestinians are left with two hard choices: to give up the homeland altogether or to die for it. There is nothing surprising that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was launched from Gaza. It is an impoverished, congested place inhabited largely by Palestinian refugees expelled from their homes during the Nakba of 1948. Gaza has also been under a debilitating siege for years, which has taken a heavy toll on its people. In fact, what appears to be the largest military response by Palestinians in decades is an inevitable development, an act of resistance, and a reaction to the suffering of the nation under a brutal blockade and occupation. It is part of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. This struggle for freedom is, however, an uphill battle. The Israeli regime, in blind rage, has undertaken a new episode of mass killing of civilians. Israel is carpet bombing Gaza. Telecommunications infrastructure has been bombarded, effectively cutting off Palestinians in Gaza from the rest of the world. Tel Aviv has imposed a full blockade on Gaza, with no water, electricity, food, or medicine entering the strip. Meanwhile, the West Bank has been completely blocked. Checkpoints closed all across, paralyzing the whole territory. Israeli soldiers are shooting Palestinians and encouraging settlers to do so as well. Genocide is in the making. Israeli jets will continue to pound Gaza as long as the Gazans' hearts continue to pound for their land. But how many more Palestinians have to get killed? How many more men? How many more women? And how many more children? Life has lost its meaning for the Palestinians, who have been stripped of their homeland. So the only thing they care about is taking back their stolen land, their own land. That's the red line drawn by their blood.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A very warm welcome to all dear listeners. Welcome to For a Better Life. This is Nahid once again being honored to be with you on another episode. The other day, I was just reading a story mentioned in Bustan, Saadi's masterpiece, the Persian poet's masterpiece, and what I found was quite tangible in what we see today in the world. But before reading it for you, let's make a case. A young Muslim sitting and wondering why are the other people, let's say rich people, having a fun time or a better time? And why not me? Then why is everybody happy except me? Why do people have lots of things that I don't? Why do other people enjoy their lives and I'm not? This could happen to anyone, like me, you, probably. Even it had happened to us before. Yes, I'm talking about greed, under the definition of wanting more. Natural to some extent to have the desire to work more, to be encouraged, but as soon as it starts to bother, to stop and to depress, there is the problem. Let's read the story first, the literary story, and then see how it goes. A cat who lived in the house of an old woman of humble circumstances wandered to the palace of a noble whose slaves repulsed the animal with arrows. The cat ran off in terror, thus reflecting, since I have escaped from the hands of those slaves, the mice in the ruined hut of the old woman are good enough for me. Honey is not worth the price of a sting. Better it is to be content with the syrup of dates than expose oneself to that. God is not pleased with him who is not contented with his lot. Well, this was the Saadi poem, and then the message is talking for itself. But also, our religion highlights the fact that greed is the excess fondness of money and fortune. It is one of the bad manners that draw to various evils and sins. It has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam, who had said, Know with certainty that you cannot achieve your desire and cannot exceed your destined life if you are on the track of those before you. Therefore, be humble in seeking and moderate in earning, because often seeking leads to deprivation. Every seeker of livelihood doesn't get it, nor is anyone who is moderate in seeking deprived. In another narration, Imam Hassan alayhi salam had mentioned, people's perdition lies in three things: arrogance, greed, and envy. Arrogance is the perdition of the religion. Because of arrogance, Iblis was cursed, namely. Greed is the enemy of the soul. Because of greed, Adam was dismissed from the paradise. And envy is the pioneer of evil. Because of envy, Cain killed Abel, the two sons of Adam. So we have the narrations in our religion that are highlighting the fact that as a true Muslim, you are not supposed to be greedy. It's okay to want more, to have goals, to set goals and work for them. Even if we are pushed and encouraged towards working for achieving our dreams and trying hard for what we do believe in and what we want. Greedy is having the definition of looking at what the other people have and then wanting more and wanting more. Like, you do have something, you do have your goals, but still, when you reach it, you're not going to be satisfied and you want more of it. There is just one place at which they say we as true Muslims are supposed to be like greedy, and that is in the way of achieving the satisfaction of the Creator.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, oh, oh,
your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
In another narration, if I want to discuss, Imam Baqir alayhi salam had said, in his love for the world, the greedy is like the silk worm. The more it wraps in its cocoon, the less it has of escaping from it, until it dies of grief. Another narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, if son of Adam were to possess two valleys of gold and silver, he would long for a third. Son of Adam, your stomach is but an ocean or a valley that cannot be filled in with anything except dust. Like, we have this also as well. Like, sometimes we want more of everything, including food, I don't know, whatever, money, wealth, and we are not going to be satisfied. The destruction that the fondness of fortune leaves of a man is more effective than any other horrible thing that we can see. Like, the Muslim's honor, however, just lies in being religious and understanding what there is for us. And in our religion, we do also have the disadvantages of greed. Like, greed, for sure, enslaves us and causes us grief. The greedy cares only for collecting fortunes without stopping at any limit whenever they achieve a goal. They work for achieving another, and so they become the slaves of their own mindset, their sick mindset, let's say, until death strikes them. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had said, I guarantee for the moderate that he will not see poverty. Like, we do have the treatment also in our religion. It is important and necessary for us to have the correct understanding that as true Muslims, we need to remember the disadvantages of being greedy. It is necessary to keep in mind that the disadvantages and the worldly and the inconveniences of greed are going to expose us to the danger of losing what we have worked hard for, like even our religion. Like, as human beings, we are going to be judged by what we believe in, by our religion, and by what our religion has asked us to do and the beliefs. It is necessary to ponder over the virtues of satisfaction, contemplating the life accounts of the great personalities, such as the prophets, their successors, and the saints, especially in the field of asceticism. Well, starting by the poem, by the, let's say, a story mentioned in Sa'di's masterpiece, the cat who was living in a good house and wanted more and went to a place that got injured. Then he came back to his origin, knowing that if you're in a situation that is for your own good, hikmah. Sometimes we have some barriers in life that they are working for our good, like we are not understanding it, and then we get greedy, we get mad at everything around us, and we stop to think. Sometimes we get that much overwhelmed. So greed is rooted as much bigger than we think. It is necessary to ponder over the achievements we have just achieved and we have worked hard for. And it is important for us to cherish the things we have received. Avoid looking enviously to the richer ones. It's like comparison, which is a disease. And it is advised to us as Muslims to avoid looking enviously to the richer ones and those who enjoy false luxuries of this world, and to consider being satisfied. It is necessary to achieve living moderation, for it is the most important factor that contributes in alleviating the tensions of greed. Moderation is the thing that can be the cure to this disease, can be the way to solve this solution, the way to solve this problem, and the way to understand how we are going to get aligned with that feeling of greed that we all may possess. Well, I wish you modesty, I wish you fortune and happiness, I wish you sa'adat, I wish you great things ahead. That was the end of this episode. Until another episode of For a Better Life, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand it crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Iranian medalists and other members of the country's sports delegation that took part in the 2024 Paris Olympic and Paralympic Games. The meeting took place in Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 17, 2024. Suppose we write a book in response to those who are endeavoring to promote the idea that the religious feelings of the Iranians have diminished. How many people will read that book? How many will see it? How many will understand it? But in front of the eyes of millions of people, perhaps hundreds of millions who are watching the Olympic Games, you reflect this truth and this identity to the world by kissing the Quran and by prostrating and thanking God. The identity of the Iranian nation includes self-confidence.